So I gave Michael this kind of long-winded rambling title because I wasn't exactly sure what I was going to try to talk about. In essence, this is going to be a talk about the dynamics of adaptation. I'll try to ratchet up the detail as the talk goes on. But part of the long-winded or sort of ramblingness of this title is that I wanted to try to put in a lot of new stuff and to try to change up the talk for this audience. Starting with first slide, putting the acknowledgments first. And so for the stuff I'll be talking about, the work that was done in my lab was done by a postdoc, Sean, three grad students, Katie, Dan, and Ryan, and a former undergraduate, Remy. Much of the early work that I'll talk about in this next hour or so was done in collaboration with Michael Desai back when he was a Lewis Sigma Fellow and I was a postdoc in David Bogstein's lab. And in reality, the initial observations that sort of led us down this whole path came after I had finished in Andrew's lab and was still hanging around Cambridge for a little bit and getting some early experiments started in Andrew's lab that ultimately got finished in David's lab and sort of led us into all the work that I'm going to talk about in the night today. And the work in my lab is supported by the Kauffman Foundation. So there's been some discussion already, and I'm sure there will be tomorrow when Andrew speaks, is what experimental evolution is, why do we need to do experimental evolution? And I would sort of argue that, we have to do experimental evolution because in nature we often have this sort of N of one problem. I mean, it's true that occasionally nature will do the experiment we want it to do and actually do things in close to ideal replicates. And this is one of my favorite examples. So these are cavefish. So these exist, you can find them in Mexico, parts of the U.S. Southwest, and they have sort of two morphologies. You have this surface form that looks like this kind of normal swimming freshwater fish. And periodically, it finds itself trapped in these cave environments. So this is nice from an evolutionary standpoint, because now we have essentially two replicate populations that are going to have very limited any gene flow between them. And so we can allow evolution to do, or allow nature to do one of these natural replicate experiments. And from these types of experiments, the cavefish, the sticklebacks, Darwin's finches, and lots of these good examples, we can learn a lot of things about parallelism and evolution. So here are two populations adapted independently, presumably with no gene flow. They have very similar morphological changes, so there's loss of eyesight, loss of pigmentation. One reason why I really like this example is because this parallelism in the cavefish extends even to the genetic level, so both of these populations have different mutations in the same gene that underlie loss of pigmentation. So we can start getting these ideas about reproducibility and parallelism and evolution by looking at sort of these natural replicates. But we never get sort of the perfect replicate experiment. So even though these are in very similar conditions, the details of these environments likely differ in meaningful ways that we're even unaware of how they're affecting our results. We're unable to do the kind of experiments we want to do, like control things like population size or mutation rate. In addition, we're limited in the number of replicates that we can do, and we're just sort of left with what nature gives us. So I think for this reason, oh, I didn't put the mic on.
Start over.
You showed up and the mic is on. Okay. So I am now mic'd, and so the first use introduction is not on record, but that's fine. So the idea is that we can study evolution in nature in replicates in very limited circumstances. But in reality, if we want to do the types of ideal experiments where we can have hundreds of replicate populations, we're sort of stuck with doing experimental evolution. So that's what my lab does. And there are lots of different ways that people do evolution experiments, and so I'd sort of go over our particular setup. So we do evolution in 96 well plates. We want to do this in a way that we can do really high throughput, and so we can do hundreds or potentially even thousands of replicate populations and evolve them for thousands of generations. To make this actually feasible, we don't do these manually, so we have robotics in my lab. So we have a biomech that we can just sort of set the deck up. We can hit start and do all of the dilutions, and dispense all the media, and do all the serial transfers. And it takes 20 minutes to transfer 400-ish cultures. And so it becomes really easy to do experimental evolution, so we're no longer limited by the number of populations. In addition, we have all these sort of nice tools that we can use to look at our experiments. And so we do quite a bit of flow cytometry. So we use flow cytometry in a couple ways just to get competitive fitness. So how much better are our evolved strains from where they started. I also talked to you about using flow cytometry to actually track individual mutations as they move through populations based upon a reporter system that we've set up. Importantly, with experimental evolution, we can freeze everything down. So we have our frozen fossil record that we can go back to at any time. And I'll show you later us making use of when something interesting happens, going back sort of to right at the point where something interesting happened, and then looking at many more runs of the tape from that point. And probably the most powerful thing that we have in our arsenal is doing next generation sequencing. So we do a whole bunch of this, sequencing evolved clones, sequencing evolved populations, and doing sort of time course sequencing. And I haven't specifically said, but we do all of our work in yeast, the budding yeast, Saccharomyces cerevisiae. I think there's a few reasons why yeast is sort of the ideal system for experimental evolution, not to slight the people doing bacterial or bacteriophage work. Yeast are, rapidly growing microorganism. You can doubling time of 90 minutes, so not quite E. coli, but close. Yeast can be maintained stably as haploids, diploids, tetraploids, so we can ask about the effects of ploidy on adaptation. I'll tell you a little bit about that at the end. Yeast can be propagated sexually or asexually, and so we can use this to ask questions about, why is sex important. We can also use the sexual cycle to do genetics with our evolved lines, and I'll show you quite a bit about that. And so that's a really powerful tool that we have that is difficult to do in a bacterial system. I mean, also, much like E. coli, yeast has a small genome, not quite E. coli size, but 12 megabases makes it quite amenable to next-gen sequencing, and we know quite a bit about yeast. We probably know more about yeast than any other eukaryotic organism. So I think yeast is a very good model system for doing experimental evolution. And so when I was at Princeton and when Michael was at Princeton, we sort of set up this system for doing high-throughput experimental evolution using robotics and 96-well plates. And the question is, what are we going to look at in this system? You can do the simple thing. You just evolve things under some condition and then look at how fitness changes over time. But we wanted to actually track new beneficial mutations as they arose in these populations and follow their sort of trajectories over time. And so to do that experiment, we took advantage of an observation that I initially made when I was finishing my PhD with Andrew Murray and finished up at Princeton, and that is for haploid yeast growing asexually, there's a benefit for them to becoming sterile. They get a fitness gain. And so yeast normally has two mating types, unfortunately named A and alpha. When an A cell comes in proximity of an alpha cell, it will sense its mating pheromone, and it will arrest its cell cycle, it will turn on a transcription of a whole bunch of genes, and it will form this mating projection, the SHMU, and the cells will fuse. Yeast normally exist as haploids, if you find them out on out a tree. They really want to get back, normally exist as diploids, and they really want to get back to the diploid state when they find themselves as a haploid. So they make lots of this mating pheromone to attract a mating partner. And there's a cost to that signaling. And so if you have a haploid yeast strain, just grow it asexually, and it's never going to see a mating partner, there's a benefit to shutting off this mating pathway. And so these are the mutations that we want to track in our evolution experiment, beneficial sterile mutations. And so to do that, we can take advantage of the fact that we can actually elicit a mating response without even having a mating partner. We can just add the mating pheromone to the culture. System where when they turn on the mating response, the cells will turn green. And then we can detect steriles in a mixed culture because when you hit a sterile strain with alpha factor, it will not turn on the fluorescent reporter. And so now we have a beneficial mutation that we can track via flow cytometry. And so we want to set up an evolution experiment to look at these beneficial sterile mutations arise and move through the population. One thing I should mention is that we can also modulate the fitness gain you get from becoming sterile. And so there are mutations in the mating pathway that will sort of dial up or down the signaling through this pathway. And so if you have what I'll call the R allele of this upstream component, you get about a 0.5% fitness advantage when you become sterile. If you have the B allele, you get a 1.5% fitness advantage.
Yes. So the advantage is in the absence of adding the pheromone. The
correct.
Pheromone is just for the
correct. Connection. In fact, if you add the pheromone, most cells will arrest their cell cycle. So it's in the absence of any mating pheromone, you have a haploid cell that wants to get back to the diploid. It's making lots of pheromone. I think Andrew's lab has estimated that the pheromone production could be on the order of like 1% of the total protein production. So this is a very costly signaling pathway, and there's a strong benefit to shutting it off.
Okay.
Yes.
But I guess, like, if you define sterility in this way, it doesn't account for the normal pheromone produced by A itself, right? Like, I guess this is only sterility in terms of response to alpha. Am I missing something?
No, it is, actually. So there are things that make you unable to respond to alpha factor, but you don't have a fitness advantage because it's not... So it's more complicated than this. There's a lot under the hood. And we actually understand it quite well at this point, but I'm sort of sparing you the details of this. But it's essentially signaling through the pathway, not just the receptor that is involved in basal signaling. You can get a mutation in, it's not beneficial. Yes?
Do you see the same effect transiently, like without any genetic changes?
The same sterility, you mean?
Yeah.
So when you hit a pure culture with alpha factor, so we use the strain, another sort of details, we use a strain that's hypersensitive to alpha factor. So normally they make these proteases that degrade the pheromone. We remove that protease. And so these things are hypersensitive to mating pheromone. And so if there really are no steriles in the population, you'll get 100% of them will arrest and turn on the fluorescent reporter. But normal yeast, if they don't find a mating partner in some short time, they give up and they re-enter vegetative growth. And so we had these two strains, and we put them through our experimental evolution regime. So we have 300 of them that would get a 0.5% of the fitness benefit if they become sterile, 300 that would get a 1.5% fitness advantage if they become sterile. We initiated these in 96 well plates, and we propagated them in a regime where we did a 1 to 1,000 dilution every 24 hours. And then we also did half of them where we did a 1 to 32 dilution every 12 hours.
Sorry?
Yes.
So what exactly are the R population? So with the mutation already?
Yeah, so the R and the B population are isogenic other than one mutation. And that mutation is an upstream component of the mating pathway. And what that mutation does is it changes the amount of basal signaling and therefore changes the cost of having the mating pathway. And we're just using it as a tool. So can we track 1.5% mutations, and can we track 0.5% mutations? And so it was a tool we were aware of that we decided to use. And so, that's essentially it. Otherwise, these strains are isogenic. And so we did this in a regime where it was either 1 to 1,000 every 24 hours or 1 to 32 every 12 hours. And either way, we get 10 generations of growth per 24-hour period. And we sort of went around this loop 100 times to get 1,000 total generations of evolution in this experiment. While this is going on, every 40 generations, we froze everything down. And then every 40 generations, we took all of our populations, we hit them with alpha factor, and we put them in the flow cytometer so we can see what fraction of the population was sterile. So we can start following these new beneficial mutations. So of these 600 populations we started with, we could detect steriles in about a third of them, so it was like 210 or something. And when we saw steriles arise, they had multiple different fates. So here's one of these 600 populations. This is as simple as things could get. So you have nothing. Then a sterile mutation happens sort of around generations like 275. It increases in frequency and it fixes. And so this is, classic selective sweep. This is on a log scale, so this we can measure the initial exponential rate of spread by just sort of measuring this initial slope of these lines. And so this sterile lineage actually initially spread through the populations if it had a fitness effect of 4.3%. So a few things I want to point out is that selective sweeps are rare. Of the 200 and some trajectories where we could follow steriles, we only saw 8 cases where the steriles actually would sweep. The most common thing you saw was clonal interference, where you'd have some sterile lineage arise, start moving through the population, and then get outcompeted by something. We had these more complicated things where steriles would come up, drop out, come up, and then drop out again, or even ones where we had sort of stable subpopulations in our evolution experiment. Yes, Reese.
Sorry, so these selection coefficients are totally different from the expected selection coefficient.
Exactly. That's going to be the next animation of this slide. Yes?
Is this the frequency of sterility or the frequency of the mutation?
So this is the frequency of sterility. So we're assuming that each of these are an individual sterile mutation, but it's possible if you have multiple sterile mutations that are moving through the population at the same time, we couldn't disentangle them by this phenotypic.
So in this upper right, sterility actually does not fix.
Yeah, correct. So sterility, the phenotype comes up and the phenotype goes away. Yes?
Can you, how do you determine whether they're sterile or not? Or how many are sterile?
So we have a reporter so that if the mating pathway is functioning and we hit them with mating pheromone, they'll turn green. And so we can take a mixed population, hit it with the mating pheromone alpha factor, and all those that turn green have a functioning mating pathway. Those that remain dark are sterile. And so it's a really nice high throughput way that we can just take our 96 well plates, expose them to alpha factor, and take the 90, we can actually condense it down to a 384 well plate and just run it in the flow cytometer. It's a very fast way of phenotypically tracking these in really in real time.
Technical question. Is there any microtiter plate effect?
Yes, there are microtiter plate effects.
I'm just curious about cross-contamination. Is that a...
So when we initially set this up, we were really paranoid about cross-contamination, so we left all sorts of blank wells. We have yet to really detect any cross-contamination. Bacterial contamination was the bigger problem right out of the gate. A few antibiotics in the media helped that. In the 1,000 generation experiment, there's very little, if any, cross-contamination. We've been doing them up to 5,000 generations now. Now we are starting to see that we're doing deep sequencing, some evidence of cross-contamination. The real solution to that is to put a different barcode in each well, so at least we can detect cross-contamination. So I'll get back to Reese's point that the upslopes here, so the initial spread of these sterile lineages is much faster than we would have expected, given the known effect of these sterile mutations by themselves, either 1.5% or 0.6%. So the interpretation of this is that these sterile lineages are not just a sterile mutation, but our sterile mutation is sort of fell on top of another beneficial mutation. And so, you know, Michael and I wrote this paper where we made all these arguments from these trajectories that these must be multiple mutations all piggybacking on top of one another. But the real proof came into when we started doing whole population sequencing of these. And so we took, to start, a single population that had a clonal interference type trajectory, and we said that we can make two strong predictions. One is that our sterile mutation must have fallen on the background of another beneficial mutation, and that there must be some other beneficial mutation that came through the population and forced our sterile lineage to go extinct. So we just, to test this, we took one population and we sequenced it. Every 80 generations, so we did 12 different time points. We did whole population, whole genome sequencing. And this is what that data looks like now. So from here on out, these will be on linear scale. And then this is the frequency of all mutations that are in this single population. And this is the corresponding molar diagram showing you sort of how these mutations fall on top of one another. You see this population does have a sterile mutation that sort of came up here at 150. Peaked around 400 and went extinct. And this sterile mutation spread faster than we would have expected, given this, that it was just a sterile. And that's because it fell within the background of this ROT2 mutation. So ROT2 was another beneficial mutation that was already spreading through the population, and the sterile mutation kind of piggybacked on that selective sweep. And then we can also see clonal interference. So we can see this IR1 mutation that occurred within this population. It actually did sweep through the population and fix, and that's why our sterile lineage went extinct. And so this was one example of this sort of whole genome, whole population time course sequencing. We did the same thing now with 40 different populations. So this gives us sort of a nice bird's eye view of the dynamics of adaptation. I don't expect you to get too much from this plot, but I'll walk you through a few examples to show you some of the sort of main observations that we found from this type of data. So the first thing we saw when we started doing the sequencing is that selective sweeps are rarely single mutations or even single phase events. And so here's a population where you wait around for a while, then you have these four mutations or five mutations that kind of move through the population in lockstep. You wait around a little more, and you get three mutations that move through, and then you get another five mutations. And so for lack of a better word, we called these mutational cohorts, since they all sort of come up seemingly at the same time and move through the population. Another thing that we saw a lot in this data is we tend to see the same targets of selection. And so here's a population where you have a single mutation in PDR5, Then you had this cohort of 6 mutations that then got outcompeted by this cohort of 9 mutations. And in both the orange and the yellow cohort, there's a KRE6 mutation. You know, so somewhere around generation 600, there's just 2 different KRE6 mutations. One is on its way up, and one is on its way out.
How do you explain cohorts?
So how do you explain this dynamic? So this is there are 2 possible explanations that typically arise. One is that it's this sort of transient mutator argument that you have these populations that all of a sudden, for whatever reason, enter a state of higher mutation rate and generate a whole bunch of mutations, and then those sweep through the population. I don't think that's correct. I think there's some evidence that argues against it. I think the real explanation is that these are just lineages. And so you have this low-frequency lineage that's just accumulating mutations over time. And it's getting 1 mutation, 2 mutations, but never, you know, they're either all neutral or it just doesn't get above the drift limit until that final driver mutation hits, pulls it and everything else up with it. And there's multiple reasons why we think that's the right explanation. But
the synchronization is puzzling.
Well, no, not really, because if you have a whole bunch of neutral mutations that are accumulating at low frequency, that's never going to really escape drift. It's going to stay at low frequency until a driver mutation hits, and then that driver mutation will be moving through the population on its own merits, and everything else will be hitchhiking along with it.
Could you have a nonlinear effect? For instance, they're slightly beneficial. Mm-hmm. You have, all of them are slightly beneficial, so you would make them higher, and then you...
Right. Yeah, so it could be that in this population you need to reach a certain threshold before you're really going to take off. And so it could be the accumulation of a whole bunch of low-frequency mutations. I'll show you later when we start doing genetics with these that these cohorts are, for the most part, one driver and a bunch of hitchhikers. Yes?
So this hypothesis, shouldn't you see more of this hitchhiking in the 1 to 32 experiment than the 1 to 1,000?
So the reason we did the different... population sizes is that we, or the different bottlenecks, we were trying to regulate population size. And so our small populations were roughly 10 to the fifth, our big were roughly 10 to the sixth. We actually saw more action in the small populations than in the big populations. Just for whatever reason, we saw fewer selective sweeps in the larger population. And they weren't dramatically different, it was maybe an order of magnitude different between them. But there was no, these sort of cohort dynamics were present in both.
Should the smaller populations support fewer neutral mutations?
Should the smaller populations support fewer neutral mutations? Low frequency neutral mutations. Substitution rate is the same. The neutral substitution rate would be the same.
Yeah, but that's not fixation.
Well, no, but when you have a lineage at the end and you want to know how many
neutral
mutations does it have, it's just the total time. It doesn't.
I think what happens in the bigger populations is you get these beneficial lineages that come up, they just take longer to sweep through the population. In fact, we saw no cases of sterile lineages fixing in the bigger populations. All 8 of the times they fixed was in the smaller population.
But you had different bottlenecks. You had the 1 in 1,000
Correct.
Bottleneck, and then you had the
1 to 32 bottleneck. Yeah. So
that's probably contributing more to the effective size than the total length.
Yeah. I mean that. So. We do go through this, you know, dilution expansion, so we have to calculate sort of our effective population size. And so, you know, these are in rich glucose media, so they'd be saturating at 10 to the 8. We do 100 microliters, so roughly 10 to the 7th, and then we do a 1 to 1,000. You know, so we have like 10 to the 4th with 10 generations between bottlenecks, so it gets us to like that 10 to the 5th effective population size, and it's a little higher. But that's basically.
Yeah, can you also say something about how you're estimating fitness? This is 6% versus 1.6%.
Yeah, so the fitness measurements of the sterile strains were done by standard competitive growth rate assays. So we had an ancestor strain that was labeled GFP. We isolated a bunch of steriles by just plating them on alpha factor. And so if they were resistant if they were wild type, they would arrest. If they had a sterile mutation, they would form a colony. Just picked a whole bunch of those, mixed them 50-50 with the fluorescently labeled version of the ancestor, and looked at how quickly it could outcompete it over, say, 50 generations.
So you went through the whole life, the whole camp. You know,
correct. We did multiple of the growth and dilution cycles.
So
Yeah, there was also that something that confused me. So you had two sterilization to background that you can measure the fitness.
Correct.
But I could imagine that you can become sterile in different ways and maybe you have different fitnesses. So
yeah, so
they all have this.
So the initial setup, so this is sort of getting back to sort of what's under the hood, is that I did a series of experiments in Andrew's lab where I made a whole bunch of knockouts at different points of the yeast mating pathway to ask if there were different fitness effects. And for the most part, they were all the same fitness effect. You just shut the pathway off, you're good. We also isolated a bunch of spontaneous sterile mutants and measured their fitness, and they were all sort of within the same range. There are other ways to become sterile, switching your mating type, which is something yeast do. And so we prevent them by doing this by removing the silent mating type cassette. So all the mutations we see, we think, are legitimate sterile mutations, and they're probably all complete shut off of the pathway. Yes?
But when I look at, when you showed your frequency of sterility, you rarely reached 100%, right?
Correct.
Okay, so that means that most likely your selection is for faster growth, not sterility.
Correct. It's absolutely for faster growth. Sterility gets you faster growth because you shut off the unnecessary production of mating pheromone when no mate will ever arrive.
But probably there are better ways of doing this.
Absolutely, and that's what we're getting to, because a lot of these mutations are going to turn out to be other ways to improve faster growth that are not sterility.
If the cohorts are just neutral, mutation accumulation, the mutation rate is a bit high.
I agree. It seems higher than you would expect. And so we know the mutation rate of these strains. That was actually what my PhD thesis was in Andrew's lab, and these are the same strain background I used for doing tons of Luria Delbert fluctuation assays. And that's actually one of the things I'd like to talk about at this meeting, is there are a lot of things that just seem intuitively off about this. The mutation rate seems like it would have to be a lot higher to get this just by neutral accumulation, with five mutations accumulating in this short period of time. I think that's something I'd love to talk about, certainly offline.
I want to use up my three questions.
Okay. Well, I'll get to more contentious stuff later, actually, and I may want to hold on to those questions.
So what's happening is neutral mutation waiting around, ticking around a low frequency, all of a sudden driver mutation comes with one driver mutation. And you'd expect cohort size to be bigger in the low population.
Well, not necessarily, because it's still the same lineage length. You know, if it's a mutation accumulation, it's independent. Population size is going to matter when you actually take off, how long it's going to take for that cohort to move through the population. But assembling the cohort at low frequency, it's just a single lineage that traces back over time.
Yes. I guess maybe the other way to get at this cohort thing is if you just take one random clone from the gray zone there at generation 300 or generation 400 and sequence it. Mm-hmm. Ask how many mutations are in it compared to these things that are seem like they're sweeping through.
Yeah, and so we've done, when I get to the replay experiments, which is a little later, we've taken when our cohort will arise, and we've gone back and we've replayed the evolution of different time points, and you can see some members of the cohort present earlier, some later, and so we have good evidence that these really are assembling over time at low frequency. So the last one of these that I want to point up, which I'm not going to talk anymore about, is we do have these cool things where we have frequency-dependent selection, and we can actually see selective sweeps within some of these subpopulations. But that's a whole other story as well. And so to come back to your question, there must be a whole lot of other things that can improve growth rate that are not just steriles, and that's certainly true. And so to really get at what are the targets of selection in this experiment, we took advantage of sort of this observation that we tend to see the same things hit multiple times across these different lineages. And so we just looked at which genes do we see observed more often than you would expect by chance. And so here are a list of the 24 genes that we see at least three times in all of our sequencing data. And so these are the things that we think really are the targets of selection. Just some evidence for that. So these 24 genes represent only 0.6% of the yeast genome by total size, but they account for 14% of the mutations we observe. We see steriles in here. That's not a surprise, since the whole thing was set up to track these beneficial sterile mutations. But we see that they're not alone, that there are other biological processes that we're targeting by selection. We're just asking yeast to answer the call to faster growth. Leading the list is IRA1, which we see mutated 21 times. But even though it's mutated 21 times, it only fixes 10 of those times. So in evolution like life, it's not enough to be good. You also have to be lucky as well. We see a lot of things in so negative regulation of RAS, cell wall assembly, cell wall biogenesis, and so these are really what we think we're selecting for phenotypically in these populations.
What's the RAS?
What's that?
Yeah. What's the
RAS pathway is essentially, you know, when yeast are growing and the conditions are changing. Think of the RAS pathway sort of as the brakes that they have to put the brakes on as they're entering stationary phase. And now if we are good grad students and we come in and dilute these things every 24 hours faithfully, you don't need to have your foot on the brake. And so my hand-waving explanation of the RAS pathway mutants is that these are sort of taking their foot off the brake and they're eking out a few more divisions when everybody else is sort of calming down. You know, and as long as we keep diluting them back into fresh medium every 24 hours, they'll be fine. And we can actually look at, you know, not only because we know exactly what these 21 different mutations are in IR1, so we can look at, you know, how we're changing the function of these proteins. And so you can see missense, nonsense frame shift, which suggests that, you know, when we're hitting the RAS pathway, we're actually, you know, killing the function of the proteins. But in contrast, with these cell wall assembly genes, the KRA6 and GAS1, we only see missense mutations, which to us suggests that, you know, at least for the cell wall assembly, we're selecting for alteration or attenuation, but not loss of function. And if we actually go in and try to phenocopy these by deletions, we can phenocopy the IR1 mutation by deletion, but not these. In fact, these are pretty sick if you try to knock them out. So this gives us an idea of what are the pathways, what are the targets of selection, but it tells us nothing about the actual coefficients of selection. So that's what I want to get at is with yeast is we can actually do some nice genetics with these populations. And so one of the things we've been doing is we've been taking our evolved lineages and we've been backcrossing to the ancestors. And so here's just a schematic of some evolved lineage, and there's 5 evolved mutations. We can take that lineage and we cross it to, so this is a MAT-A evolved clone, we cross it to a MAT-alpha version of the ancestor. So this will now make an A-alpha diploid that will be heterozygous for every one of the evolved mutations. And using sort of clever yeast genetics, we set it up such that this diploid is also going to be heterozygous for the dominant drug sensitivity gene CAN1 at 2 unlinked loci. We then do some other yeast tricks. We convert this diploid to being a MAT-AA, so it is a diploid cell, but it thinks it's a haploid MAT-A because we've removed the MAT-alpha information. We can then still sporulate this by putting part of the MAT-alpha locus back in on a plasmid, so now they're back to thinking they're diploid, but genetically they only have MAT-alpha information in the nucleus. And then we can sporulate this sort of in bulk, and we can plate these on these really big plates that contain the drug cannabinine. This will kill all of the diploids and 3/4 of the haploids, but we can get, you know, pools, really arbitrarily large pools of, you know, 10 to the 6th or usually 10 to the 5th or 10 to the 6th is what we aim for, that are essentially in the same background as the evolved, but have random combinations of all of these mutations. Now, there are certain caveats to this, whether or not these are genetically linked and so forth. And so using this trick, we've been making these really large pools of these progeny where we essentially, you know, use Mendel to shuffle the deck and get all of these different combinations of evolved mutations. And then once we have these, we pull them all into a single well of a 96-well plate, drawn here, I guess, as a test tube. And then we can do a what we call bulk fitness assay. So we have these really large pools of like 10 to the 5th segregants that have all random combinations of the evolved mutations. We can propagate that pool over time using exactly the same regime we did in the original evolution experiment. And then we can monitor the change in frequency of all of the mutations by next-gen sequencing. And so this gives us, yes?
So are you like propagating them in the back, like with like a bunch of ancestor in there or something? Like
there's no ancestor in there. So one concern is it, you know, is fitness changing dramatically in these populations over time? There's no ancestor because we want to just take that whole population and sequence it rather than having to separate out the ancestor prior to sequencing.
And then does that might that like change like what fitness is like, right?
No, it certainly could. And so yes, it's because the mean fitness will increase as the pool changes over time. But we have evidence that we've done the sequencing that in most cases, it's not like alleles are fixing in this competition experiment. They're just enriching slightly
measured. More just like in that original evolution, right? Say like some IR1 guy fakes that, like, you know, might change the dynamics of, say, like the nutrients in the population, and like might change like what fitness means, like from.
Yeah, so I think there certainly are some caveats to doing this bulk fitness assay. I think when I show the data, it seems to work reasonably well, that we think that, you know, we're getting the answer we want. One of the things I do want to point out, though, and so this is one sort of caveat to this as well, is that when we measure the fitness of like this red allele in this bulk fitness assay, it's not like the fitness of the red allele in the ancestral background. It's actually the fitness of this red, you know, mutation averaged across all possible backgrounds on which it can occur. And so we call this sort of the background average fitness of all of these mutations. So here's a simple example. So we put a few simple populations in there because we can, you know, have a reasonable expectation that we can interpret them. So here's a population where the whole experiment is shown here. I've grayed out the mutations that are not in the lineage that we've chosen to backcross. So in the lineage we chose to backcross, there were only three mutations, ELO1, GAS1, and STERL12. So we took this, we made our really large pool, and we propagated that pool forward. And this is sequencing now every 20 generations. And so this is our bulk fitness assay. You see, the ELO1 mutation basically stays completely flat. So the interpretation is that this was a neutral mutation. It did not enrich in the pool. But STERL12 and GAS1 both increased in frequency, and we can measure the slopes. This is the log ratio of the evolved to the ancestor. And this gives us a very quick way of getting the background average fitness effect of these mutations. So this is much easier than the old-fashioned way of actually making all of these allele swaps. Making these allele swaps is challenging for things like GAS1 that are actually sick when you try to knock them out, and so this pop-in, pop-out methods don't work. And this is easily scalable, and so we can start doing this with populations that have lots of evolved mutations. So here's a case, I think there's 23 or 24 mutations that were in this lineage. So we came to generation 1,000 or something, we picked a single clone, we backcrossed it, we made a large pool of 10 to the fifth segregants, and we propagated that pool forward over time. Now here's the traces of all of those mutations using the same sort of color scheme. The one thing that sort of is striking at first is that most of the lines are flat. What this means, so to get back to your question, most of these look like they're not affecting fitness at all. Most mutations that we fix in this population are hitchhikers. If I just highlight the three of those that have positive slopes, it's ROT2, IRO1, and MID2. And then we can sort of map those back onto the dynamics. And we see that we have three strong driver mutations that correspond to these three main selective sweeps in this population. And then we have a bunch of hitchhikers. Yes?
Does the rate of increase in these bulk competitions predict the rate of increase?
It doesn't quite. And there are a few reasons why you wouldn't expect it to. The rate of increase in these bulk is the background average fitness effect of these mutations. But here, there are a few things that can slow it down. Like, let's say this IRO1 mutation, there's this general idea of diminishing returns epistasis that, you know, if you get this ROT2 mutation, this IRO1 is going to give you less benefit on that background. And so that could slow it down. But probably the bigger thing that slows it down is clonal interference, that something that's moving through the population, there's no one else there that it's competing with, is going to move sort of at its own merits. But if it's competing against another large fit clone, it will really slow the rate of adaptation. So we haven't looked at how they're correlated, but when we've looked at a few cases, they're not like predictive by any means. Yes? Oh, sorry.
Is it just by chance that the one that started with the highest frequency in your bulk competition is also the one that went up first?
This is weird, this spread. So, you know, according to, you know, Mendel, everything should start at zero. There's a few reasons why this doesn't quite start. The axis does start. The first time point we did was 10 generations into the competition, and so the frequencies were skewed a little bit. Anything that affects sporulation, spore germination, will skew. And so there are reasons why, you know, things that were in a heterozygote, when you get a bulk spore prep, are not quite 50% of the pool.
But it's also ordered by the appearance.
Yeah, I think that's coincidental.
And do you have any expectation how epistasis would work out in these?
Yes. So epistasis, and I'll show you one example of epistasis. So if you have synergistic epistasis, let's say it's something that's neutral on its own, but is really beneficial in some condition, it would start off shallow, and then as the epistatic pair increased, you'd see an inflection and an increase like this, and we do see that actually. So one of the things we did, this paper we just published like a week ago, that we went back and looked for deviations from nonlinearity in these, and there were at least four good examples of deviations, and one of those was a synergistic epistasis that had an inflection. Okay. And so we've done this now, I'll show you two examples. We did the same thing with 11 different clones that were selected from 9 different populations. So from some populations, we picked 2 clones that were competing at the same time, just thought maybe we'd see something from that. And so this is the fitness effect of 116 different mutations measured across these 11 populations. One thing that's comforting is we were able to detect at least one beneficial mutation in each of our populations. One thing that's interesting is that we observed one and only one case of a deleterious mutation. So this is the thick bar is like the standard error of those, the regression of those plots I was showing, and then the big bars are the 95% confidence intervals, because sometimes we lost a point here or there. There's only one case of a deleterious mutation fixing, and this is actually kind of an interesting one. It's like a stop codon read-through in GCN2, which is involved in stress response, and we're not actually sure if this was really deleterious under the context it arose, but this shows that background average is deleterious, and so this is one that we actually want to look at in more detail. Since these are all new, I have to remember what I'm going to next. And so earlier I showed you how we tried to predict what the targets of selection were by looking at what we saw hit more often than we expected by chance. And for that, we sort of set the threshold, is that if we saw it more than twice, we said it was probably a target of selection. So here's that cutoff, this 2. These are all ones we've identified as drivers by this bulk fitness assay, and these all were ones we also identified by just recurrent-based methods. But what this shows is that this bulk fitness assay identified things that were missed previously. They were missed either because they were low fitness effect mutations, and we only saw them once or twice, or in this interesting case, as I'll get to a little bit later, we missed them because they were rare, and they were rare because they interact epistatically. But it's nice, it's comforting, and this has the added thing that we actually not only identify drivers, but the magnitude of the effect of them as well. So this, I want to mention the one thing next is what some people still find a little contentious about this. And so this is where I was kind of expecting questions on the next section, we'll see. So coming back to these cohorts, we took all of these 11 lineages that we had done this bulk fitness assay on, and we wanted to objectively identify what we were calling cohorts. And so we do this just to show using hierarchical clustering. So these are the same trajectories just shown as a heat map. And then we cluster the heat map, and then we use the same sort of threshold for all of our populations to say, here's what we're going to call a cohort. So operationally, what a cohort should mean is that you should be able to go into this population, and you should, if you kept sampling, you would always find all 3 of these mutations or none of those 3 mutations, that those are really in the same genetic background. And so we went through these 11 populations. We identified 31 clear cohorts by this method. And then we just simply asked how many driver mutations and how many hitchhiker mutations are there in each of these cohorts. So this is a plot of total mutations per cohort and the number of driver mutations we were able to identify. A few of them had 2 drivers. One was the interesting epistatic one that I'm going to talk about a little later. Most of them had sort of 1 driver mutation, but a third of them had no identifiable driver mutations. So here's, mutations that we saw moving through the population, and then we did our bulk fitness assay, and often there was just a single mutation in these 5, but sometimes they had up to like 5 mutations. None of them could claim to have a fitness effect by our bulk fitness assay. So we're really puzzled by this, and then we started looking, because the whole goal was to map all of our driver mutations back to the dynamics. We started looking at what these things were actually doing in relation to the known driver mutations around it. So we have this thing that we've been calling, again, probably for lack of a better word, driverless cohorts, which are essentially, you can think of them as multiple rounds of genetic associations. Okay, so I'll sort of go through 3 examples of this just to show what we mean. So here's a mutation. So on all these scales, everything that's dashed is either synonymous or intergenic. Solid lines are coding sequence mutations. So here's either like a synonymous or intergenic mutation that comes up, and then it fixes. But it's not beneficial. It comes out as neutral when we reconstruct it using this bulk fitness assay. So how do you explain these dynamics? So the way we explain it is that you had this cohort A that pulled this mutation up. And so you can think of it, you have a mutation that is beneficial, and it's going to move deterministically through the population, but it's drifting around. And then within that background, you get some variation as well. And so you have this neutral mutation that occurs within that background. And so you now really have two different lineages. They both have these two mutations, but one of them also has this mutation. If they both escape drift...
It's a soft sweep.
It's a soft sweep, yes. So they'll both move, escape drift, and they'll move through the population. And then when the first one fixes, this one sort of will get dropped off, and its fate is really determined by where the next beneficial mutation occurs. And by chance, the next beneficial mutation occurred within its background. And so in addition to getting pulled up by this first cohort, it then gets pushed up by this second subsequent selective sweep.
Wait, why did you say soft sweep?
It's very analogous to soft sweeps where you have, yeah.
The A mutation could still have had a single unique ancestor, right?
The A mutation, would have had a unique ancestor, but then B happened within that background.
Within that background. So this is probably still a hard sweep at the A locus? Hard sweep? One de novo A mutation, and just one of them early on acquired a B mutation.
B mutation, yeah.
When there were about five of them.
Exactly. So that's the thing, is that this must be occurring, you know, at the point of... And so one of the things that I would like to think about here is that we're trying to predict sort of the relative slope of this versus this should be determined by what fraction of the whole A had an additional B in its background. And that same parameter, whatever you call it, will also determine, let's say nothing else happened afterwards, it will determine the point at which this B got dropped off and hung out as a neutral mutation. So this is stuff we're really just starting to think about, and I'd love to chat more here. Yes?
Yeah, so I'm confused. So in which group would B go as a cohort?
So the way we've defined cohorts is I said operationally you can think of a cohort as if you can go into the population and you can't find a cell that has one but not the other. So that B is its own cohort. It's a cohort of one, essentially. It's a single mutation that's moving through the population.
Okay, so I'm sorry, but I'm confused. I thought you wanted to explain why you get cohorts with a whole bunch of mutations in them, but none of them is a driver.
Yes.
How does this explain this?
Well, B is a cohort of its own with no driver. It's not any other cohort. No other mutation shows the same trajectory as it, right? A sweeps too early, C sweeps too late. B is a cohort of one mutation, no driver.
Oh, are the drivers the ones that are now fixed?
So the driver in A fixes, and it's undoubtedly the solid line because we see no evidence of synonymous or intergenic. So this solid line is the driver. It pulls this dotted one up sort of as a single cohort. But then also a subset of them that had these also had this B mutation. But B itself has no demonstrable effect on fitness.
But B was driven up by the one that is fixed.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes, it was, so we said...
The drivers that we are looking for are the ones that are finally...
Exactly, and so that's why I said this is really... This trajectory from going from here up to here, you explain by sort of two rounds, multiple rounds of genetic associations. First, it sort of gets pulled up by piggybacking on A, and then it's done with A is fixed, and then it's, the rest of its movement through the population is dependent upon the second round of genetic association with these drivers that occur within its background.
So you was expecting these driverless cohorts to have non-typical increase profiles.
Non-typical increase.
Right, so they're
just biphasic. They do weird things. This one's biphasic. Maybe I'll just put up the other example. So here's another one that looks kind of biphasic. So here is a cohort. A driven cohort, again, to stretch the weird analogies.
Exactly.
And then here you have the C, which comes off and kind of shoulders off, gets dropped off around 50%. And then this other driven cohort, D, arises and pushes it up through the population. But nevertheless, you had a 200-generation window here where this was sort of the majority polymorphism in the population. It ultimately fixed, but it is neutral by all measures that we can do.
But don't you expect to have, like, mostly one mutation in those cohorts? Because two is really unlikely.
I agree. There's a lot of things, and this comes back to sort of what's going on under the drift level. I don't think we understand it all. I don't know if this is related to, coming back to Bruce's question, the fact that we propagate these under, you know, bottlenecks, the dilution bottlenecks. We don't really know what's going on.
Having two means that those two mutations occurred after the first mutation. So your argument before that they were lingering or they were around for a long time doesn't hold anymore, because this time you know that they occurred after that first.
Correct. But it's still, you know, after you have a lineage, it picked up this mutation, it picked up this mutation, then you have multiple variants that are all drifting around. Maybe you expect one of those to go out and one to...
It's not drift, it's expansion that's happening. So if you have a cohort that's increasing, you would expect that these driverless cohorts are actually expanding. You're getting a huge amount of ability to pick up multiple mutations. It's a very large population size relative to the rest of the population. And I guess I'm wondering if you are more likely to see these driverless cohorts after a adaptive cohort that has a very high fitness effect. So, like, is the rate of that expansion, does that have a relationship on whether or not you have...
That's a good question. I mean, we haven't looked. We're just... So this is still... This data is fairly new, the description, and what we really want to do is work out sort of a more theoretical understanding of what might be going on in these. And so that's a good point, though.
Maybe you'll get to it. I mean, one of the virtues of doing these things is you get the ecology of the evolution, changes in densities. Mm-hmm. What is happening? Are they growing faster? Are they reaching stationary phase earlier? Is there a struggle lag? What is the evolution?
Yeah, so in terms of the known driver mutations, we have examples of ones that increase exponential growth rate, like the steriles. We have examples of ones that get you out of lag phase quicker, things like GAS1. And we have examples, like I mentioned earlier, that essentially help you in stationary phase by just taking your foot off the brake. So we actually have cases where the gains in fitness come at all different phases of the cell cycle. So
So you have the total population, not just frequency data. You have total end data as well.
Yeah, we don't have total end data, but it's easy enough to get because these are all frozen down, and we can just revive them, grow them up in the same conditions, and get the total end data.
Could B be reappearing in different backgrounds?
It's unlikely to get the exact same neutral mutation in different backgrounds, so I don't think it's that.
So if the first plateau that B hits is around 20, we can call it 25%, mm-hmm. does that mean it has to arise at the second division?
So if everything was deterministic from the get-go, then yes. But in reality, these things drift around a lot, and so it's not clear how long things are drifting. But that's sort of like that's sort of the intuition, though, that if it's there in 50%, so this one kind of levels off almost to 50%, so the interpretation is that you had, you know, this mutation, and then you had two mutations in the next cell division.
Yes,
but I don't think that's... But I don't think that's what's happening. I think what's happening is you have this lineage that still, even though it has a large fitness effect, it's still going to drift for a while. It's not, you know, going to... And so while it's drifting, you have other variation that comes up within its background. And now you have two lineages that are both drifting.
Okay, 10, 20 generations, maybe.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think this is... That's why... This is what I said is going to be the most contentious part.
Can I suggest that we... I mean, it's obviously puzzling, right? We all know it's puzzling for various reasons. But why don't we move on and we can discuss these kinds of things after.
All right. So there's something. Another one. One more piece of evidence that these really are neutral, though, is that if we look at, you know, what's in... driven cohorts, ones with a known driver mutation. This is the spectrum of those mutations. So high impact or frame shift, nonsense mutations, as well as things predicted by SNPF to be large impact. Moderate effect or things predicted by SNPF to be modest effect, amino acid substitutions. Low impact are synonymous, intergenic, or low impact in a sense. And so if you look at all mutations from adaptive cohorts are here. You split this up into the hitchhikers within an adaptive cohort. It shifts downward. Driver mutations, it shifts up. And if you look at the spectrum of all mutations in our driverless cohorts, it looks a lot like what the spectrum we see in hitchhiker mutations. It's another piece of evidence that these probably really are true hitchhiker mutations. They're just hitchhiking over, you know, different genetic distances. Okay, so I'll get through this last part, and then the final part we can save for some other time, maybe. But with this, we also identified a pretty interesting case of epistasis. So all else being equal, here are the background average fitness effects of all of the mutations within this clone. Now, if everything's additive, there's no epistasis whatsoever, you could just add up all of the sort of driver mutations, and that should give you the fitness effect of the evolved clone. And so we did that experiment. So here's the additive expectation for all of these clones, and here's the actual fitness of that evolved clone. And this line in orange is sort of the slope of 1. And, you know, there's a trend. For the most part, things tend to fall near the line. But there was one really strong exception to that. And so this population became really a target of our investigation. We suspected there may be some genetic interaction within this population. This looks pretty boring from the surface. You had a single sterile mutation moving through the population. It really got blown out of the water by this cohort of 11 mutations. This is the only case of a cohort where we actually saw GoTerm enrichment among the mutations that were there. And so here are the 11 mutations that were in this cohort. 4 of them localized to a Go compartment, you know, the bud neck, sites of polarized growth. All 4 of these are either nonsense or missense mutations. And so this is more evidence that maybe there's some kind of genetic interaction going on within this population. When we look at the bulk fitness data, it's actually pretty crazy. So we had 2 mutations, and for whatever reason, they came out really low frequency in the pool, but they sort of blew right through our bulk competition assay. And KEL1 is one that actually deviates from linearity when we do analysis on it. And so we had a pretty good feeling that KEL1 and HSL7 were interacting. And so we took, I think it was several hundred segregants from this cross. We genotyped them all by whole genome sequencing, and then we did fitness assays on all of them. And it turns out the only 2 mutations that had any effect in any context were KEL1 and HSL7, and they had synergistic epistasis. So here's wild type. Here's putting KEL1 in the wild type background. It's basically a neutral mutation. It's actually somewhat slightly deleterious, perhaps. HSL7 is kind of a modest effect beneficial mutation, 2 or 3%. When you put them together, you get something like an 8 or 9% fitness advantage. And so this is a really cool example of synergistic epistasis arising in a low frequency before this thing sort of, blew out of the water. And so one of the things we're starting to do now, and this is where I think a really cool application of experimental evolution could come in, is that, we have something interesting that happened. And I'll go back, because we think one of the other things that was surprising is this KEL1 mutation. If we look at all of the reads of this population, we can detect KEL1 around generation 300, but we can't detect HSL7 until close to 500. So it kind of looks like this neutral mutation was there for a while, and then this epistatic mutation happened, and that's what drove the cohort through the population. And so to get at that, we've been doing a whole bunch of evolutionary replay experiments, where we've been essentially going back to different time points in this population, reviving the population and splitting into a whole bunch of replicates and re-evolving it. So I'll show you 2 of these replay experiments. So I just need to orient you, because every time you see this is a little confusing. So what we did is we went back and we tracked the frequency of the sterile lineage. So we started 48 replicates from generation 270, which is before the KEL1 variant arose, and 48 replicates from generation 375 after this KEL1 variant arose. And then we used the same phenotypic assay I described earlier to track this sterile mutation again. Now, this sterile mutation was already an appreciable frequency in the population, so in many of them, the sterile just won this next round. And so these are the frequency of the sterile. The shading is just to give you some visual pleasantness for aesthetics. And so in a lot of these populations, the sterile is still fixed. And so we know our low-frequency lineage didn't win that replay experiment. But some of them, the sterile again went extinct. And so now it's a chance that maybe it was our same low-frequency sterile, non-sterile lineage that slipped through the population. But it could have just as easily been any other low-frequency non-sterile lineage. So to distinguish between those, we took advantage of the first mutation in this cohort that we can detect is IQG1. That is not too important, but it introduces a restriction site. So anytime we saw a non-sterile lineage win this evolutionary replay experiment, we said, is this the same lineage that won in the original experiment? Before KEL1, the answer was zero. After KEL1, we see, you know, in some of the replay experiments, the same low-frequency lineage shown by these dotted lines has again won. So this is sort of brand new data. We're just doing these evolution experiments now. And so I have a grad student, now we've sort of figured out what generation we want to replay. He's now replaying hundreds and hundreds of these so that we can get enough of these replay experiments with the same lineage one to do, you know, sequencing and see, is it finding the same epistatic mutations? Another way I like to think about this is sort of, this is a screen for genetic interactions. Because here we've shown that KEL1 and HSL7 interact epistatically. These two genes are not known to interact physically or genetically. And so we think KEL1 has opened up some new space. And so we sort of want to use this replay experiment to explore that space. So we've done sequencing on one just because we were doing some other sequencing. We're like, let's just throw one of them in there. And so here's the original evolution experiment. The ones that were present prior to the restart are shown in blue, IQG1, KEL1, and one of the intergenic mutations. And this was that epistatic interacting mutation with KEL1, HSL7. So we sequence the one replay experiment. We can see, you know, these three are still there. You get a whole suite of other things as well that are here but not there and vice versa. And then we happen to see HSL1. And so now we think, you know, we haven't done the reconstruction to show that HSL1 interacts epistatic with KEL1, but I'm willing to bet that it does. And so we're now replaying this experiment over and over again to try to get an idea of how many different new paths are open to this population. So I could probably stop there. I was gonna do stuff on the diploids, but I'll skip all this. That's the summary. So I told you about experimental evolution. We did a long-term evolution to look at sterile mutations. Then we did a whole lot of whole genome, whole population, time course experiment to really get a good picture of the dynamics of adaptation. Combining experimental evolution with quantitative genetics to get at these things of like driverless cohorts, identifying a case of epistasis, now using evolutionary replay experiments. And I didn't have time to talk about ploidy, so I guess it's good that it said maybe ploidy stuff on my title, so it's at least true to that. So thank you guys.
I guess I have a kind of dumb question. So if you go back to the driverless cohort example, the graph, it's a relatively simple example. So I understand how the A is pulling the B in the first graph up, but when C is pushing B up, shouldn't B never be able to go above what C is? Like, I guess I'm confused. Like, isn't it only a subpopulation that is being driven up? Is it just a random chance that B's...
Well, but there's C, and there's a couple things that are competing within this background. And so, in reality, if there's a whole bunch of things that are pushing up on C, C shouldn't be able to go above the sum of the frequency of those subpopulations. But here, at least two of those subpopulations, there are things that we don't know that are probably also in those populations. I'm also not showing ones that were not in the lineage that we use for the bulk signal. So there's actually more mutations that were in the original population that are shown in this plot.
Thank you.
So for the driverless cohorts, do you end up getting ones that kind of get pulled up once and then die out as well as one?
Yeah, exactly. So when we did this, we're now looking back at sort of all of our populations and seeing, are there certain traits we can use to identify what we think look like driverless cohorts? And we do see cases where they come up, they get dropped off at 50%, but then the next beneficial mutation occurs in the non-it background and it goes extinct.
So can you use that to try to quantify, like, you know, try to test this model, right? Because, like, you would expect then, like, you know, if you have a bunch of guys who get driven.
Yeah, and so the probability that the next beneficial mutation occurs in the that it will fix is going to be dependent upon the proportion that it is in the population.
I think it's like a quantitative test of.
Yeah, and so that's one of the things that you know we'd like to really move into is sort of what's going on below drift, the relative slope of these driverless cohorts versus what's pulling them, where it levels off, and sort of what's the probability of it taking the next, making that next genetic association. Like I said, this is all very new.
Can you say why you think it's not bursting mutation?
So, I mentioned, you know, when Lynn asked what's going on with these cohorts, and one idea that, I mean, I really like the idea of transient mutators, that, you know, all these things are working in complexes. If you make too much or too little of a protein, you could very well enter a state where the cell is in a higher mutation rate for a short period of time. One, the strongest piece of evidence is when we've done things like the replay experiment, we show that they've actually occurred over a span of several hundred generations. But the first reason why I was inclined not to believe that is that all of these mutators have their own very distinct spectrums. Like mismatch repair mutants have lots of frame shifts and polynucleotides. Translesion synthesis has like multiple errors clustered together. And so we look to see, is there any shared mutational signature amongst mutations that are in a cohort? Like if cohort B here had every one of the mutations was like a mutation in a polynucleotide run, I would strongly entertain the hypothesis that this is a transient loss of mismatch repair. So there's a few other reasons like that that I'm less inclined to believe it. But the primary reason is when we actually have done the experiment of going back, so the replay experiment, we rewind it to different time points, and we see some of the members of the cohort are there, but others are not. Really does say that they're assembling over a long period of time.
Wait, on the plot that you actually were just pointing to?
No, not this plot. I'm just gesticulating.
I mean, on that one, they happen at the same time, right?
Yeah, but the replay experiment, we could actually go back and restart it, and some of the mutations would be there, but not others.
I mean, if you replay that one.
I would predict the same thing, yes.
What? Really?
I would predict that if we went back here, 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 and let's say we could find ones where this B lineage still fixed again. That's a little harder to do. But let's say we had a selection for it. There's some selectable thing here. Then I would predict that we would see time points where one of those mutations was there, but not the other two. One when two, or one when...
But, I mean, the actual mutations that are the reason why this plot is on the slide, right? The driverless cohort, right?
I would predict that these probably... we don't know, honestly.
Wait, can you just finish this? And what do you...
So the question is, these two driverless mutations, did they occur in the same cell division or not?
Yeah. Or one after another, yeah.
I'm willing to entertain either hypothesis. I'm not...
You think that they could have occurred?
How
I think they could have done.
But I mean, just can you point any other way that they could have occurred? Just give me an example. Yeah, tell me.
Okay. So you have So you have a beneficial mutation that occurs. This is this B lineage. So this is drifting around. Once it escapes drift, it's going to move up to terminus. Yeah. Okay. Within its background, mutations are happening. So you get a neutral mutation here. Now you have two lineages that are different, and they differ by one of these neutral mutations, and they're drifting around, okay? And
are they both escape drift at the same time? That's the thing.
What's the maximum gap that you think that could possibly have occurred between the two in the occurrence times of those two mutations?
I mean,
it's a handful of generations, right? It can't be more.
No, it can be approximately infinitely long because that's how drift works.
Yeah, they can.
They both occurred on the B background, right? You can see when the B background occurred.
No, you can't see when the B background occurred because it also drifted before it went up, and this is not a log frequency graph. This is a linear frequency graph. Just think more carefully.
But then they have to coexist at an intermediate frequency within a drifting lineage for a very long time.
The question is when they both get seized by selection, and apparently that was like two generations apart.
Well, no. I'm confused as hell by this, but maybe in a slightly different way as you guys. They don't. I mean, you are right, of course, Daniel. The B lineage can't drift around forever. It should drift around for a time of order 1 over its selection coefficient at most, which is you know, maybe, what is the selection coefficient? Maybe 3%. So, like, we're talking about 20, 30 generations kind of time scale. In that time, it could certainly be the case that, you know, one mutation occurs and drifts up to half of its frequency, and then a second comes and happens to pick. I mean, that's not impossible.
Right.
But, so, I mean, I think it's clearly possible that that could happen via, like, some two mutations 10 or 20 generations apart.
Yeah, exactly.
And then they... I am still confused because I think... And I think what you're getting at, maybe, is that it all seems kind of unlikely. And so the question is really, like, can, you know, could we make some kind of computer simulation of this just that just contains these ingredients where you would get this kind of event happening with any kind of reasonable probability, right? Because this happens multiple times. It's not like a one-off event. And that does seem implausible, but it's not, I mean, it's a job for someone like you to try it.
Well, actually, I mean, was it Emil who suggested sequencing individuals who are not sweeping and to see, like...
How many did they get?
Yeah, like, if you take one that's not sweeping...
Yeah, I mean, so we could simply go into a population, isolate, you know, 1,000 individuals and sequence 1,000 individuals. And that's an easily doable experiment.
So do you think at the later time point, you see two mutations have different frequencies? Do you think this is your inaccuracy? Or...
I think that's within error. I mean, I think the error is...
I was thinking of the seed lineage, but it doesn't matter.
Oh, yeah, I think that's within the error of... So I'd be willing to bet that this seed lineage is a 50%. It's an easy experiment to go in. Get 100 that, you know, 100 clones, and you expect half to have both of these and half to not. And I don't think you would find clones that have one but not the other.
Right. That's what I wanted to ask. What should we imagine are the error bars on each of these?
The error bars you can almost imagine is sort of the width of this. So this was sequencing, deep sequencing to 100x coverage on average. And the error bars are going to differ because the genome coverage differs. And so for some of these things within a cohort, we may have a 200x coverage, some we may have 30x coverage. And so the error bars, it's hard to say exactly what they are because coverage varies, but you can see the width of these is sort of visually
then,
that's sort of
400, that's quite wide.
Yeah.
Right. So I mean, we have to keep in mind that's sort of the spread we're playing with, right? In interpreting what we're looking at.
Yeah. No, I agree.
I just have a question. So about this drift thing, is what does drift look like within an expanding lineage? I mean, is the reason that you guys are thinking everything has to happen very early is because you're not considering that there's perhaps a prolonged, I mean, I don't know the answer to that. There's a prolonged period of drift because this is happening inside of an expanding lineage, which is within that lineage is effectively neutral, and
stuff gets frozen in very quickly because of the exponential expansion. Yeah. You only get the first few generations where you get drift, and then it frozen. Even with the diversity in the lineage, it's really dominated by the early generations.
We'll go back here.
I think it's time for lunch. One of the things that might be important, I mean, you said it at the beginning, but can you remind us again what the actual bottleneck size is?
Bottlenecks were, so the effective population size was about 10 to the 5th to 10 to the 6th. The bottlenecks were 10 to the 4th to 10 to the 5th.
Okay,
that's rough.
Okay, let's thank Greg and go for lunch.